right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. The microphones have been pulled out of the closet and heated up, and the room is heating up. Welcome back, everybody. First of all, to the to my magnificent left is Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
You do have a magnificent laugh.
I do. I don't make shit up like that. That's
well, hello, John, and everybody.
Yeah. Good to have you back, Zilpha.
I'm nervous.
You're nervous?
Yeah.
It's okay to be nervous when you're new.
I'm not new. I'm old.
Rich?
Hi there.
Welcome back, Sir Rich.
Thank you,
Rich, a fabulous member of the board of directors of Whitefields, the parent company of Mormon Expression.
Good to be here. Thank you.
We are putting a bid in for Twinkies. I heard that Hostess is selling off its brands. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, so are they going to be unavailable now? Or
I'm sure somebody else will buy them.
But they won't be the same.
You remember like animal crackers?
Uh-huh.
You know, when Mothers went out of business, but they sold off the brand. Don't fear.
Okay.
You'll be able to get your munchy fix.
I'm settled. Thank you.
And then we have a fabulous studio audience who, as they grab the mic, will... We'll have them
entertain us with their wisdom.
Welcome to Studio Fist in Your Face. Is it all you dreamed about? Yeah.
Probably hotter than they
overwhelmingly
dreamed about.
Yes.
Okay, so one of the reasons we're recording is I threw a challenge out there for fundraising. And I said if we raised – for every $100 we raised, I would record a podcast before the end of the year. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, we raised all $600. So for the next few Sunday nights, we'll be here coming at you back again with the old crew.
Sweet.
We are committed.
We are committed. And that kind of leads into the topic. I have in my hand – I was cleaning out some stuff the other day. And I have in my hand a My Temple Recommend.
Does not have a barcode on it.
It does not have a barcode. As a matter of fact, it was issued. The issue date is June 2002. I will pass it around the room. Which means that it has been 10 years gone since I got my last Temple Recommend. And that I've been thinking about that a lot this year. This year has been a year of reflection and introspection for myself. And I found that a few months ago, and I've been thinking about it since, because 10 years is a long time. We're not here on this green planet for very long, and 10 years is a good chunk of it. And that 10 years represents a lot of change for me. And I've been, you know, fairly intimately involved. I first got on the boards, the online, you know, DAMU, whatever, the Disaffected Mormon Underground. You know, in about 2003, I was still an active member, and that's when I first started participating in various roles on the boards. So I've been sort of – it's been about 9 years now that I've been actively observing and involved in the ex-Mormon community. And that's sort of what we want to talk about today. One of the questions that is fundamental – to everyone who's had a crisis of faith is the question of recovery, the question of getting better. And I don't mean to start off the whole discussion here from the bowels of pessimism, but I've become convinced it's impossible. It's not something that can be done.
But that's with some caveats, because there are circumstances that would better lend themselves to full recovery.
There's healthy living.
Would you think it would be healthy if it could be done?
I like many before me have wished that I could become a non-Mormon,
a never Mormon.
that I wish I could extract it all from myself and from my being, and so many have tried. And if you hang out in any of the groups or on the board in Post Mormon or in the, you know, the Mormon Expression VIP lounge or whatever, about every month there'll be somebody who dramatically, with a flair and gusto, claims that they are done with this and they are moving on and yada yada yada, and they always return, they always come back.
Mm. Well, the thing is that even if you're ready to move on, it's all around you. If you live in Utah, And even if you don't, you have family members who are, and you've got all these psychological vestiges as well that pop up, and they pop up unexpectedly, and it's not like you can just suppress all of that because it pops up.
So let me ask, what's the definition of recovery? Is my question.
Well, I think that's an excellent question.
That was Cody.
Hey, Cody. Welcome to
Hello.
Studio 1A.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Cody.
What's up?
You look very good.
Thank you.
Hey, so in our culture, we have a metaphor of time as a journey. And we talk about the past being behind us. We talk about walking the metaphor, a shared cultural metaphor, is that we're walking down a path and the future is in front of us and the past is behind us. And you'll see this metaphor come up over and over again. That's a cultural construction we have. That's not a universal construction. There are other cultures that view the journey through time as walking backwards, meaning you're walking down the path with your back to the future because you can't see what's coming in front of you. You can't see the path that you're about to tread on. But what you are doing all the time is surveying where you've been. Your view, your vista is constantly this the sum total of every step you've taken, of all the places that got you to wherever you are right now. And I think that's a more apropos model, because we are constantly in our minds, and we're wired to be thinking about and be processing and relating everything in conjunction with everything that has happened to us, and that can't be extracted.
Yeah, I mean, if we didn't have that feature, we wouldn't learn. That is how we learn, and that's how we know that we're growing. If we never can see where we've been, we don't know where we are.
Yeah. And for somebody like myself, who spent 34 years in the church, in various stages of belief, and trying to make it work all the time until I left, I was always trying to make it work. That invades almost every aspect of those 34 years. I mean, my education was at BYU, you know, my marriage was in the temple, you know, my 19, 20, 21, I was on a mission. As a young man, as a teenager, you know, my Tuesday nights were at Mutual and my Sundays and were at church, and it just...
And even our children were adopted through LDS social services, and then they were sealed to us in the temple.
Right, and it just is so consuming.
Again, let me ask, what's the definition of leaving the church? Like, what is it? What is
recovery.
Exactly leaving it behind to you guys?
I don't think there's a hard and fast, and that's why people sort of struggle with that. There's no like golden point at which you can say, I've left the church. Because even if you send that damn letter in, we're so surrounded by it. And I think this year has shown what, you know, because as Mormonism becomes more of a cultural influence, people pay attention to it more. You see that. Even if you had divorced your family and moved to Timbuktu or whatever, if you followed the election at all, I was listening to the radio this morning on the media, and there was a discussion about one of the reporters who was covering the Romney campaign who happened to be LDS. You know, it's just... And for us that grew up in the church, I mean, every time that's mentioned, it brings back this whole flood of emotions and memories and connection that just can't be done. And the people that I see that try to just sort of dismiss it to
pretend that it was never part of them,
it doesn't work.
Not possible or healthy to do.
Well,
that.
When you spend your entire life living that way or fighting against it and time, you know, going back and forth between believing it and fighting against it, you know, there's a point where when you start to study it, reality sets in. You know, you go, okay, look, the entire world may believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet. The entire world may believe that whatever, Nelson receives revelation for the church or whatever, but reality is different from that. And you look at evidence, you look at reality, and you can't really deny that it's bullshit. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, and that's where I think the disconnect is for a lot of people. They don't want to face that it's obvious. You know, right. I'm sorry, but
no, but that's what we're talking about, right? I mean, it's just where you're at.
Because I think the problem is that once you've dismissed it or come to any kind of terms with it, you know, if you follow sort of a New Order Mormon or you know, Dalinian model where you can kind of make it work.
But why are you trying to make it work?
Well, I mean, let's even dismiss that question. You're still confronted with this mythos all the time and people around you all the time. And that dismissing it outright and realizing all of the error in the religion, all the myth that is really myth, doesn't necessarily help you socially or even intellectually deal with this history that you have. Because what you do is you reverse. You say, for 30 years, I believed something that I now believe is false. Or for 30 years, I believe something I now believe is partially true, or that is a metaphor, or that is whatever it is. You still have this thing that you become detached from, and this way that you process the world and interacted and made very heady decisions that you no longer buy into. And it's almost like, this is going to sound sacrilege, but it's almost like arriving at the idea that the church is or is not true is not really the key issue. It's dealing with the fact that you were part of this thing, right, that you are disassociated
from.
It's your role.
Almost like trying to completely disassociate yourself from your family that you grew up with. Like, or like long-term friends.
Or your friends, your family. I mean, we're all around this all the time. And it's our world, whether or not we want it to be. It's the world we live in, and you can't divorce yourself from everything that you know.
But it's and I agree 100%, but it's the world we live in because it's in your head. You know, like if you were to move to you know, someplace where there's no Mormons, you know, and try to live that way, you still have all of that baggage of who you were, and you cannot escape that identity.
Well,
you,
is that really that bad? I mean, Mormonism, I mean, a lot of things about Mormonism is fine. It's great. In fact, it's good. But does that mean we have to reject every single thing we ever learned from it or everything we got from it? I mean, the fact that it's fundamentally false does not mean we have to reject all the good things we got from it. That's kind of how I look at it. I was raised Mormon, and I learned a ton of awesome stuff from the Mormon Church. But does that mean that it's true? No, not at all.
Well, and I think that's part of the dilemma that we all go through. It's extremely hard, just like I was talking about, I can't extract Mormonism from my history. And it's extremely hard to even extract Mormonism from just plain old decentness and good behavior, and because it colors every little thing.
We give Mormonism a lot more credit than it's due, I think, just as a natural
sometimes
species.
Definitely. I mean, because there's a lot of things that they do that you can find in virtually any religion, you know, from Hinduism to Protestantism to whatever.
I think the church likes to take things that are good, that they see are innately good, and they try and adopt them and say, look, that's Mormonism. That's us. I mean, everything that the spirit, spirit, quote unquote, testifies of is from us. And that's bull crap, you know? I mean, I don't know how else to say it.
They want to claim all of the goodness that humanity naturally has to offer.
Right. Like, I was having a conversation with my buddy last night, sorry, but he was saying, you know, the church makes me – I ripped on Brigham Young University and just said, look, he made some comment about BYU and football team or whatever, and I was like, I've been a fan of BYU my whole f-ing life, and – but now when I see Brigham Young University, it really just chaps me. Like, I cannot like Brigham Young. I can't be cool with that because I know Brigham Young was a piece of crap.
So, never Facebook, you know? Drunk.
Yuck.
Right. So that's seriously.
Cody, just for a reference, when was the last time you went to church?
It's what? Over a year now.
A little bit over a year.
Fairly,
you're still fresh in that stage, and that stage of anger is real, and it's the feeling of being part of a fraud. You know, people say the old thing, you know, why do people leave the church? They can't leave it alone. Because it's not human nature to be ripped off and not sound the alarm.
That's right.
It's not human nature. You know, I've said before to people who said that to me is, What kind of psychology would that be to spend your whole life in a religion, come and suddenly decide it's true, and then just be able to just walk
and not say
away
a word about it?
Not decide it's not true.
That's dumb.
Yeah.
It's like an insurance company, as Sid was saying. If you got screwed over by an insurance company who was being, you know, less than ethical, you're not going to just be quiet about it. You're going to say, oh, you find out somebody's also has that same insurance policy. Guess what you're going to do? You're not going to be quiet. You're going to tell them, hey, guess what? These people are full of shit, you know?
Well, hey, I know John said this before about, you know, if religion works for you and you're happy, then why not? I mean, it doesn't work for me. It never made me happy, so I left.
Well, it's the same reason that you shouldn't rob banks if you're happy with it.
And that was Brandon.
Hey, Brandon.
And then the female.
I'm Brandon. I'm an ex-Mormon, but I'm not angry.
The voice before was Angie.
It's Brandon. I don't mean to belittle your point. It's an excellent point. And what I tell people is if they are happy in the church, do not mess with them. Don't do anything with them. Now, the church itself, I have no problem going after the church. The church is a corporation and not a very healthy one at that. But the people of the church, because the psychological trauma, we'll talk about this a little bit more, of leaving the church is real. And I've seen it play out in 1,000 lives and in my own life, and it is difficult. Does that mean we should go back? Well, hell no. I think a great metaphor. I was thinking about this the other day for the church. Have y'all read Lolita? Mm-hmm. Nabokov's book. And I can't remember. Angie, do you remember what the name of the narrator is?
No, I don't remember the name.
All right, so I'll sum up for all of you who haven't had the pleasure of reading this book about
incest.
Incest and creepy pedophilia. Because of internet porn, you've
probably
already heard the word Lolita.
Heard of it anyway.
So the narrator talks about how he gets stuck, he gets fixated on about 14-year-old girls, and he ends up marrying a woman and then having an affair with her daughter. He sleeps with her daughter, Lolita. And then the mother dies in a tragic incident. So he is both her
caregiver,
abuser, and caregiver.
Yeah.
But he cares for her and he loves her both as a step parent and the sole caregiver, and he's sexually attracted to her and he feels responsible for her. Well, Lolita eventually leaves him, spoiler alert. Lolita leaves him and she goes on this wild tear of a life, and you know, she gets involved in porn and just all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, because she was abused when she was a kid. Near the end of the book, he finds her. He's well-to-do, and she's living in some trailer park somewhere, and she's pregnant or whatever. And he feels this compulsion to take care of her, to provide for her. And I can't remember exactly how she says it to him, but she says,
"So he asks if she'll come back, and he'll take care of her."
Yeah, basically. And she says, and she's talking about this guy who'd stole her away from him in the first
she'd
place.
She'd say yes, right?
Well, the guy stole her, got her involved in pornography and other things.
Yes.
And he said, I was still happier with him than I was with you.
Lolita said that.
The reason I bring this up is the church was both our protector and our abuser. So for ex-Mormons who sometimes walk down forbidden paths and can get their lives screwed up in 100 different ways, people say, well, why don't you come back to the safety of the church?
Because wasn't your life better off there?
Because you were both our abuser and our caregiver. Mm-hmm. And there's something that's creepy and there's something that's worse about that. And even though you had lots of money and you had lots of means to take care of us, the fact that you were abusing us when you shouldn't have been abusing us makes it so any other forbidden path, any other form of chemical slavery or whatever, mm-hmm, is better than that form that we had underneath the church and will keep us from ever going back.
It seems like you're talking about reality again, you know? It's like, it doesn't matter how, I don't know who it was, Carl Sagan or something, he said, no matter how amazing or how fantastic the myth is, it's not worth, I mean, reality's much better. Reality's just as mysterious and it's just as amazing, and why are we pretending like things are a certain way when reality's just as amazing and it's better? you know.
But it can be, bad. We can go places that will hurt us.
You have to own your responsibility in that place.
Right. Nobody's taking care of us.
Being an ex-Mormon,
what are you talking about?
Being an ex-Mormon is not going to make you happy.
You can get addicted to things that the church says don't ever touch those. Well, when you touch those and you use them as medication and you get addicted to them, it can be dangerous to your health and it can be dangerous for your family.
What's a good example of that?
Canned fruit.
Like alcohol?
Could be alcohol.
Well,
it could be
ex-Mormonism has no opinion
some kind
on
of
anything.
Drugs?
Should you take a mistress? Should you leave your wife? Should you take heroin? Should you put a gun to your head? Should you just anything in the world?
Should you kill someone you're really angry with?
Ex-Mormonism has no opinion on. It will give you no guidance on any of those. So leaving the church does not provide you happiness. It doesn't provide you anything.
There's nothing to take care of you.
Right. Well, to take a second, though, because the church doesn't do anything for you in those examples that you said anyway. They say, pierce your ears this way.
They tell you what to do and what not to do.
But on minor scales.
But afterwards, unless you join another religion that tells you what not to do or what to do.
But they don't.
Why does religion have to tell us what to do? Why can't we decide for ourselves?
Zilpha and I have had the opportunity to meet lots of very interesting people. There was a couple we met. They had been reading the Doctrine and Covenants, and they had joined up with a polygamist called, they'd read DNC 132, and they joined up with the polygamists that are here in Lehi and Santa Quinn, Cody, what's-his-face, they're from the television show, that group. They were with them for a while. They were currently trolling...
Dating sites
and swinger hookup sites to try to find vulnerable women. This is in their words. These guys had bounced around, and I sat and listened to them talk and tell their story. They were just lost in and it was their kids were playing when we talked with them. I won't give you all the circumstances where we met up. We met with them on neutral grounds. We'll say that, but their kids were filthy, and they clearly and they didn't look well taken care of, and they, as they told their story, just one harebrained scheme to make money after the other. Their lives were a wreck. And I remember sitting there thinking, saying, these guys need to go back to church.
Oh, no.
Because they weren't making it on their own.
Miserably.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's for everybody. I think people need to find their own way out.
Well, it's like marijuana.
Or their own way to survive this life that is difficult.
I'm all about science.
Yes,
that's
you
your
are.
Way. That's your way of surviving the life.
For people to leave without knowing what's really reliable in life, and that is science.
Well, Cody, what does science tell you about drinking alcohol?
Tells you it's going to screw your liver over if you drink too much.
Right, and a certain percentage of people will become addicted to it. And a certain,
right.
But science doesn't tell you to do it or not do it.
It can't tell you exactly how much you can drink to not get addicted and not hurt your liver.
Yeah, but it can tell you a range of amount of alcohol that you can drink that is
safe.
You know,
but it could could not be safe.
Says the pharmacist.
Yeah, like
I think he knows.
I mean, you have to.
You just
research
don't know.
It.
It's uncertain.
If you want to die of liver cancer, then drink a 750 mLs of rum every night.
But most people won't do that.
Well,
then
people will be okay, likely.
Likely. That's the thing, though. There's no certainty. If you never drink at all, you know you're not going to injure your liver with alcohol.
Right. So we should join the Mormon church and be baptized.
And there's plenty of certainty.
Uncertainty that you have to embrace.
So? What's wrong with that?
The thing that's hard about it is, was it Jefferson that said the price of freedom is eternal vigilance? I'll find the quote. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. It's Ida B. Wells. The idea still holds true, which is to be free, you have to constantly be managing it, okay? The problem once you leave the church, and I've seen this play out in 1,000 lives, is the church says don't drink alcohol. The church says go to bed early. The church says this. And what it does is it frees you from thinking about those things. You do not have to decide every Friday night if you're going to get drunk or not. And the alcohol is a trivial example, actually. But there are headier moral questions that run into that when you abandon a stricture like the church has, you have to take on moral agency. And that's what's funny, because it turns the church's teaching completely on its head, because what the church does is it dismisses you from moral agency, because it says, we will tell you exactly what to do and when to do it and what not to do.
And like, they say the greatest gift from God to man is free agency.
Yeah. I'll give you probably the biggest example I see playing out.
You to exercise mm-hmm. it.
The biggest example playing out in ex-Mormon lives is marriage. When you get married in the temple, you are married forever. And if the marriage is crappy, if the marriage is boring, if the marriage is not meeting your needs, well, you first of all have an eternity to work that out anyway, so that doesn't matter.
Right, just deal with it.
You know, like if you're having sexual dysfunction or whatever, it doesn't matter, because in the long run, you know, you have the eternities to work that out. Mm-hmm. But once you leave the church, and especially if you go into the route of atheism, there is no compelling reason to stay together except your choice to stay together. Yeah. And in a sense, then, you have to keep deciding over and over and over and over again to stay with that person, mm-hmm. which can be valuable to the relationship, but it can be morally exhausting.
It's honest either way, though. It's honest either way. If you have to sit
more honest.
Every night, if you have to sit across from your partner and say, do I want to be here right now?
Uh-huh.
That's honest.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm saying it's a better way to live your life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's exhausting.
It's more difficult.
It's the shit.
It's super exhausting. And I was saying this the other day to a girlfriend. My life is wonderful and I love it, but it's so much more complicated than it was before when someone else was telling me exactly what to do, A, B, C, and D. Now, every day, A, B, C, and D, I have to make decisions about what I do and how I do it and who I do it with, where before someone told me it was boring, but a lot less complicated.
It wasn't your life.
No, that's true.
I kind of look at it like, if that's okay with you, then maybe that's what you should be doing. If that satisfies you to have someone else tell you what you should and shouldn't be doing all the time, then maybe you belong in the church.
Well, yeah, and that's why religions evolve.
Yeah, I just recently ran into a sister missionary who was a good friend of mine on my mission, and I told her that I had left the church, and her first reaction was, "The church is what keeps my marriage together. It's horrible, but we're still together." And I just was
cringe.
Facepalm, and just
man,
I was. I felt so bad. Like, I didn't know what to say. That was her only reason for staying in the church, was that she could stay in a bad marriage.
Mm. And the only reason to stay in the bad marriage was because she was still in the church.
But I will give the church this: a lot of problems we run into in life are transitory. What one thing that religion does is it provides social glue. Because I was reading a book recently on free will, and the author pointed out is about mind physiology and free will. And the author pointed out the free will is something we only want for ourselves. We actually don't want, you know, I want Zilpha to be completely predictable. I want to know when she's coming home. I want to know how she's going to react. And we want people around us to interact with us in a certain way. We don't like people who are completely free, who are completely unpredictable. If Cody says he's going to show up to the poker game, I want him to show up at the poker game with $10 in his pocket. Is that free will? What religion does is it takes and it lowers the teenage pregnancy rate potentially. Now we can argue about whether that's true or not, because the problem with religion is a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, right? And the organizations start serving themselves rather than the individual. But there is a social good that we all experience by having others socially engineered to behave in a certain way that benefits us. And that's the really the negative part of religion. But when you cut everybody free, and everyone in this room has seen people who have left the church and have started making one piss poor decision after another that have long-term ramifications.
Speaking of long-term ramifications, decisions that we made in the church, we knew what the long-term ramifications were going to be. We knew if we did the things that the church asked us to do, we would get this eternal reward. And if we didn't, then we'd get a lesser reward. Because everybody gets rewarded.
It's like endure to the end, you know? What am I enduring exactly?
Right, but
why am I enduring anything if I only have one life to live?
When you're out of the church, you make a decision, you don't know what the long-term ramification is going to be. It's very unclear. But in the church, you knew what you were doing was going to result in a good something later.
Right.
So did you really know that, though?
When you say only one life to live...
Well, yeah.
Why?
Cody.
Like, what are you talking about, exactly?
So I'll give you an example. I have seen enough people leave the church to say that probably the divorce rate for people leaving the church, even if they both leave together, is probably pushing 75%. And the reason is...
I'd question it, but not to say you're wrong, but I'd question it.
The reason is people get married young, at 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. They're out of the church for a while, then they look at their partner and say, I've only got one life to live. I've only ever f***ed one person.
Check.
And I've got 30 years left.
And that's a long time.
Yeah. And that's a long time. And I've seen that sort of thinking comes up again and again, and it's not wrong thinking, but it can destabilize people's lives because they can suddenly say, "Holy shit, I've only got 30 years left," and I
just need to go fuck a lot of people.
Yeah. So what's the difference between that and a midlife crisis? Yeah. I mean, why are we talking about Mormonism right now?
Because Mormonism is what we are.
Most people fuck a lot of people before they get married. That's the difference.
I think it's true, and I think you have a good point. I think a lot of people, I don't think it necessarily solves the problem, but for a lot of people, they go out and figure out who they are, and then that's the life they settle into. Because in college, they try different things out.
And they choose a partner that sort of fits who they've figured out,
or a lifestyle, or whatever. For a lot of us, we were just sort of pushed right into one thing after the other.
And the assumption is that that's different from someone who goes out and is promiscuous with a lot of people, and then finally finds somebody they get married to. I don't think it's much different.
Really? One's healthy, one's like laid in front of you.
I think the only difference is one person doesn't realize that what they have is no different from what the other people have.
Cody, you have an excellent point, but I think one of the problems is the ex-Mormonism clouds people's thinking. And I think what happens, and we've all seen this, there's people who leave the church and they become an inverse. They become the
opposite of what
they flip
really,
Mormonism.
They become
so,
18 again.
So whatever Mormonism said not to do, they're going to go do it. And they're going to do it just because they are an ex-Mormon now. Yeah. Right?
Well, why not?
Just because they're not a Mormon.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I've seen college-educated people like do things like take heroin. All right? You don't do stuff like that. I mean, because that doesn't make any sense, right?
No, do not do that. Stupid.
Kitty has claws.
So I mean, just crazy off the hook stuff. I have seen men and women who go to church on Sunday who've left the faith. Serially, like, pick up people at bars and sleep with person after person after person after person on the DL, and it's just like, whoa, hold on. I mean, you have a 14-year-old kid at home. You know, this is going to bite you. And I think that one of the things is it still goes back to the church, but the church and reacting to the church clouds vision. And I'm not trying to make moral pronouncements.
No, whether it's right or wrong, it's still pretty immediate. It's pretty irresponsible to just jump through those kind of hoops that quickly.
The results.
Time is the great variable, right?
Right.
I mean, you need to just let the time settle and you need to let yourself settle into who you are. Find out who you are outside of the church.
Yeah, and so that.
But that's a hard thing to land on.
Absolutely.
Because it takes a long time to...
Longer than I've been alive.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, do you ever really land on who you are?
No.
I don't think it's possible.
There would be no fun in it.
Who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, what would happen if you did that? Yeah. I mean, your life would be lame after that.
You'd be a Mormon after that.
That's true.
Right? Like,
I mean, because I knew who I was
Isn't
when
that
I was
what it's
a Mormon.
Yeah, you know exactly what you
it
wanted, where you wanted to go.
Clear.
Where you were before you
And
were
now
here.
Everything is unclear.
So... Yeah. So, I mean, what we're talking about is the ex-Mormon rumspringa, which is extremely common, which is...
Well, first explain rumspringa terms of Amish.
So rumspringa is and I'm probably mispronouncing it, it's like Germanic. For the Amish, they have a tradition where they raise their children in the faith, like you do, but they say you can't join the faith until you're an adult. So what typically happens is around about 18, it's 16, I think it's actually a little bit young,
they
get cut loose and they're expected to even go into the city and go try the world.
For like a year, right?
Well, they can't join until they're 18 or 19.
Right, so they've got time.
And they have rules like you have to be free from addiction, like, because they don't drink and they don't smoke and all that kind of stuff. But the idea is these kids go, and there's documentaries about this out there, like The Devil.
I'm only basing all this on Kingpin, the movie, and I don't think I'm qualified.
So these kids go out and they have raves, and you could talk to the Pennsylvania police. They try out a bunch of stuff. They get really involved in drugs and sex and everything, and they're expected to. The majority of them actually go back to the faith, but that's a side point. But they're expected to go out, and so they know what they're giving up. They know what choice that they're made. I just use the word because they go out and they go a wilding.
Try everything.
And there's usually a stage that most ex-Mormons go through. Some of them go through it right away. Some of them go through it
very slowly.
And what it is, and it's not necessarily they have to sample everything, but what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to reconstruct their entire moral basis. And I would assume if you slip out of Mormonism and become a Jehovah's Witness, you don't have to go through this. But if you lose religion, you are going to have to reconstruct painfully every moral that you have.
And that's what you're saying, atheism, right? I mean, that's so if you go that far, then you really do have to deconstruct every single moment,
yes,
every single thing.
Well, I feel like as I was growing up, I was constructing my morals and then trying to conform them to what the church was teaching. And that's what inevitably led me to leave the church, was that they couldn't line up anymore at all. I didn't need to, once I left, construct my morals. I already had them.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent. But it invades everything. Politics and what you watch on TV. And
what you let your kids watch.
I think the thing that makes it more complicated for ex-Mormons is that not only are you dealing with your baby vampire-ness and experimenting with everything, but you're also dealing with all the anger and the hate and the sadness and the depression from leaving all this behind and being lied to for 20 years and all of that. And so it's more than just being a 19-year-old normal teenager as a 40-year-old. It's everything. And it's a lot of baggage and stuff to deal with.
And you have, like, unlimited resources.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty rad.
Unlimited resources, like money coming out your ears.
Yeah, right? I mean, imagine like being 16 and because that's your whole goal when you're 15 or 16 is to try and define who you are. And when doing that when you're 30, you kind of have a little bit more ammunition.
Well, I mean, you have
a lot more on the line, too.
That's true.
Especially if
that's
you
very true.
Have a spouse and children.
But you have an excellent point. If you're a reasonably normal person at 40... you want drugs, you can get drugs. You want sex, you can get sex. You want all at 19, it's actually harder to score some of those things than because you don't have the resources or the means to get them. And you have this world in front of you, and oftentimes it starts just with coffee. I'm going to sound like a confidence talk, but you know, once you realize that you can
the gateway drug.
then you have to at some point hit your own barrier, but life is a journey, and I think for a lot of people, and I think this is sort of what you were saying, Cody, you can kind of go through it and say, well, I can make those decisions as they go, but it's really hard without a religious basis to make a decision and make it stick.
Why is that so hard?
What would it be, character?
Well, like,
what would it stick to?
I have
why
some friends
so
who drink to maybe excess sometimes, and then they say, oh, we better back off on the drinking for a while.
Ah, lovely common sense and reality.
But then they go back to the drinking because they're like, well, what, you know, it's not
fun.
That bad. We can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think there's things
and?
Like...
It's natural.
Well, there's no decision morally. Well, there are few decisions morally. Like, I don't think it's ever right to kill somebody because you're angry with them. But there are lots of decisions that you'll never settle on a hard, fast rule. Like, I will never drink more than 3 drinks in one night. That kind of rule, it doesn't stick, like John said.
No, but you could say I'm not going to plan on drinking more than 3 drinks 2 days in a row, or whatever it is. I'm not going to say what the rule is.
Yeah, but then
but for everybody, you know, you don't want to drink a six-pack every single night, or a fifth of vodka every night. You don't want to,
but then if you do it, did you do something morally wrong?
I'll give you an example.
Why
one that
do
comes
you
up.
Have to make a rule like that? Why can't you say, okay, that was clearly too much?
That's what I'm saying.
Am I going
is
to hell for that?
No,
of course not. But
rules.
Do I want to do it tomorrow? No.
It's all constructed, and it's a constant process trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I think the basis has to be trusting yourself, though. That's been a big thing for me, because I feel like I put all my trust, all my faith in the church. Now that I've stepped away from it and realized I can trust myself, I know when something's good, I know when something's bad.
I really like that, but I've come to the point where I know when I'm not to trust myself.
Yeah.
I know
that's
that
I've learned that too about you too, John. Yeah. It's knowing when you can't trust yourself.
Right. And you also have to take responsibility for your shitty decisions.
Well, that's what we're at. That's the whole point.
Well, I think if to go full circle, I mean, we could talk about you know all these different circumstances you run into, and it does happen. I mean, you decide, say, drugs are stupid, drugs can get me in trouble at work, drugs are illegal, and you make that decision, and then you're at a party with a bunch of well-to-do 50-year-olds who have a hookah and inhale or something, and those decisions don't stick. And that's what I meant when I said you have to re-decide all the time. And oftentimes it's because the moral basis you were making the decision on the first place might be faulty. But that there's a responsibility to that. There's an ownership of that. And making the decision and having responsibility is important, and it's an important part of being a grown-up and navigating this world. It doesn't necessarily make you happy. Mm-hmm. And that's what religion is selling all the time. It's saying if you follow these rules, X, Y, and Z, you will be happy. But what we've all discovered is it's bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, I guarantee you that all you people leave in the church, you will meet a happy adulterer. it'll blow your mind when you meet them that they do it and they're perfectly fine, and then you'll meet other people who are happy potheads, and you'll meet people who are following all the rules and doing everything the way they should, and they're miserable. Mm-hmm. And it's just things are not as simple. And if you go to the church, they're all zombies in there, right? You know, that's that they're selling happiness, but they're not really delivering.
So are we saying
press on?
Yeah. So then the prescription for happiness is just owning yourself.
Well, happiness is a transitory phase. The prescription
you can't
is
be
it,
happy.
It doesn't exist.
What?
You can feel happy
in the
on
moment.
Occasion,
you gotta set the guidelines every day.
For me, I'm a strong believer in happiness is a choice. I think we always have that choice, even when your life is shit and nothing's going right. You still have that choice to say, I'm either going to choose to be happy and deal with things that are coming my way, or I'm going to be miserable. And what do I want to be? Do I want to be miserable if I can choose between happy and miserable?
If you can choose between happy and miserable,
you need
if you
Jesus.
Can, then you can.
Then you're lucky.
You don't have much of a choice, really.
Well, not all people can choose that.
Is choosing misery really a choice? I mean...
Well, and there's yes. a lot of it is chemistry.
It. Yeah, a lot of it is what's going on in your brain.
I don't buy it.
Buy that.
You guys can attack me.
Buy that.
What don't you
chemistry,
buy?
Chemistry bullshit. I buy we have control.
Wait, stop. You don't believe in clinical depression?
Whoop. I believe in clinical depression, sure. Do I believe that people have the ability to get themselves out to make the choices they need to make to get out of it? I do.
Sometimes they need a little bit of jump start.
Yeah, if you've never
though.
Been right. in a clinical depression, you might not be able to sympathize.
I was clinically depressed, and I'll say that as soon as I left the church, it cleared up. So,
well, wait, today?
No, right. Once I wrapped my head around the idea that I was leaving,
I think the clouds went away.
When we talk about depression, we're talking about a lot of things. I mean, there are physical problems with the brain that will cause people to feel certain ways.
When you're sometimes about, like we can schizophrenia,
we can
or
induce
bipolar. Then
yeah,
sure.
yeah, yeah.
If you're talking about regular depression, my personal opinion is that a lot of people buy into.
Well, that's because you used a weasel word. You said regular.
Your type of depression.
Yeah.
Oh, depression. Period.
Well, but you're not an authority on the subject, brother.
How much of it is our own choice, and how much of it is us convincing ourselves we don't have a choice? None, in my opinion. If you don't have a choice, then why do you need to tell yourself you don't have a choice? If you, why not always try and tell yourself you have a choice?
I think people do try to do that. I think everybody who's depressed, nobody wants to be there. And they all say, hey, I'm going to feel better today. And then they're like, I just can't.
And everybody goes through phases. And that goes to the point I was trying to make, that there's no silver bullet. And you're going to wake up some point and not be happy with what's going on in your life. With what's going on in your relationship, what's going on, whatever. And some of it can be external.
And one thing we did as Mormons, at least what I did, is I would pretend I was happy when I wasn't. And
is that happiness?
No. No, but I would try to convince myself I was happy doing things that I wasn't happy doing.
So what's better, pretending you're happy or finding every single ounce of responsibility on your own part that you can take and trying to change every one of those things? And if you can do every single one of those things and change and you still are depressed, then yeah, maybe you need to go talk to a doctor and get on something.
Well, I wasn't depressed, but I was pretending to be happy. Yeah. I was trying to be happy.
That's something that happened, like you can lose your job.
In a situation that it was, you know, I just wasn't happy doing. Yeah. Like, well, just pretending to be happy isn't always the solution.
No. We're all talking about a religion that we've grown up in, and we're probably talking to a lot of people that are depressed. And it's a real thing. So yeah.
Right.
Get yourself checked out.
I'm not saying
turn your head and cough.
For sure.
You're good.
Right.
I probably depressed myself. Heck, I don't know. So I'm not always super happy.
On this podcast and in other areas out there, we tend to focus on evaluating the truth value of the church. There's really, in terms of, and this goes for if you're leaving the church or finding a comfortable middle way. This the same model goes. So I'm going to talk about in terms of leaving the church, but I don't want y'all to think I'm just talking about that the solution is leaving the church, because this goes for anybody who goes through any kind of crisis where it's like you get jarred out. It's like you're sitting there watching a movie. And have you ever been watching a movie that you're really into and you're just sucked in, and then something happens, somebody coughs or somebody says something, and then you just get pulled out of it. So that circumstance happens to people in the church. So you either can get back in. Some people can, or you're going to have to resolve it.
When Sydney and I first started doubting, it was kind of like that. We were like, it was almost a joke. It was almost like surreal. Like, what if the church is not true? It was almost like a joke. Kind of like, can you imagine how crazy that would be?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, based on how faithful we are right now and how completely we believe it, can you imagine how crazy that would be? And, you know, it kind of started us thinking, like, geez, we have a lot of cognitive dissonance right now. We should probably clear that up, because that would be crazy. It would be freaking insane, you know? And turns out, guess what? It's not. You know?
And it is difficult to deal through those things. And that's why things like Mormon Expression and a lot of other resources out there exist to help people through that phase. It is a tough phase to get through, because you have to do some deprogramming and you have to ask some very difficult questions that it's almost like your mind is not wired to ask. And you have to keep sort of rebooting the system over and over again. And I think that's very important. And there's a lot of support out there, and things are getting better.
Well, a lot of people, when it first happens, they feel literally like maybe they're crazy.
I did.
Very isolated.
Alone.
Very alone.
So that's the first thing for people leaving the church. The first need. I'm talking about, there's two real needs that everybody has. And that first one is to intellectually or emotionally. And it depends on where you are on the scale. Like the dialogue tends to be dominated by people who are really intellectual. But there's, for a lot of people, leaving the church is more emotional than it is. I think for most of us, we fall somewhere on that scale. Yeah. And you have to process through both of those, accepting emotionally the idea that the church is not true or it's not what it says, as well as accepting intellectually. So that's the first phase.
But that emotional acceptance can hit you in the face out of nowhere.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Out of nowhere.
Much harder. And I think, too, there's an element of an embarrassment, you know, because so much in the church we hear, I know for a fact, I know with every fiber of my being, you know, and to say that you doubt that, like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you get it right, you know? And so getting over that embarrassment is hard, too, to come out to people around you, you know.
Well, and for failure, you know, because the church is set up, the whole program is set up so you can't succeed.
You can't fail either. I mean, as long as you're in the church, you won't fail.
Right, it's a double bind.
Like you say, they program that into you. So if you doubt, if you leave or whatever, you know, you don't pay your tithing, your house is going to burn. You're going to lose your job. Like, all these horrible things happen.
Yeah, it's
a scary step.
It's set up so you can't fail. It's set up so you can't fail if you follow all the steps.
Exactly.
But all the steps are designed so you can't follow them all. That's
it's set up so you can't win as well.
Yeah.
Well, they do that so you feel guilt, so you continue to go to learn how you can, you know, like
avoid
it's just,
that guilt. It's a spiral.
Well, and also everybody says how scary their life would be if they weren't in the church, and that their life would be, you know, in shambles and
sure.
So it's scary if you've only known to some extent. The church and you've never known a life outside of the church. It's hard to imagine your life, you know, without
because they define success.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Especially I think in Utah as well, you know, where like those who, well, I guess it's changing now, but those who used to not be in the church were infidels and just doing all these horrible things, you know, drinking and gambling, the bad part of the population that you don't go towards, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So that's the first thing that processing. And once again, that's things where Mormon Expression and a lot of the other resources out there. There's the second part though. And actually for the last probably year and a half, 2 years, it has consumed my thoughts more. So, and that's the structure that the church provides and churches, and this same discussion we're having here verbatim would apply to Jehovah's Witnesses and Baptists and Evangelicals and Catholics and whatever else. That we're really not talking about anything uniquely Mormon here today. But there we have certain social needs. We have a need of a sense of community. We have a need of a sense of belonging. When we talk about those moral decisions that we need other people. Like our brains evolved basically interactively. We never evolved to like be deciding and doing things on our own. Morality would have always been a function of the group,
the culture,
and the problem is once you become an ex-Mormon, you're defining yourself in negative space. And that doesn't provide you anything. It's a point I made 20 minutes ago. It doesn't tell you how to live your life. It doesn't give you any social structure. So one thing that we have been, as ex-Mormons helping each other, we've been really good and getting better at that first part, that emotional / intellectual support and helping others deconstruct the church. We have been shitty at the second part, and we've all suffered for it. And it's very hard. The second one is difficult to achieve. And Zilf and I were talking about this earlier today. I have noticed that there is a tendency in the ex-Mormon world to attack anybody who comes at with a solution. If anybody comes in and says, say, hey, I'm a Unitarian, you can go to the Unitarian church, or they say, hey, I'm into yoga, or whatever it is, there seems to be this cultural zeitgeist that wants to preserve this problem space, that wants to preserve this fucked up ex-Mormon world defined in relationship to the Mormons, and they will. I'll give you an example. I went on to the Salt Lake City post-Mormon Facebook board and announced our Las Vegas, and I got attacked for crossing their group. Now, what those motherfuckers don't know is I am the chairman of the board of the Post-Mormon Foundation. But the point is, the Las Vegas trip, we talk about in a second, was designed specifically and solely for social connection, for providing community to folks. And we specifically banned any formal, there was no formal mention of Mormonism at all. And just coming on and doing that in a territorial sort of way. So anybody who has even decent outreach, there is a divide element, which is you can't come in with any sort of solution. So rather than have this,
well, it's like, but this is our space and our solution, and we have to protect it.
Or even our space and our non-solution.
But I think it might, it's not just that there's not a solution. I think it might be fear of being led into something
misled,
like the church again, you know, because
absolutely.
I know for me, I went to the Unitarian church for a while and then, it was longer than that. Anyway, but I went there and they recited a chant that they say every Sunday, and I got freaked out and I was like, no, I am not doing this again.
This has been hard
enough to leave one weird, you know, cult for another. Exactly.
Yep. No, it that's why I say the second half of that problem that I define is the difficult problem, because I'm afraid that what we're doing, and I saw this with Unitarians when I was a Unitarian, you would see lots of older Unitarians. And they'd raise their kids in the Unitarian church, but you'd very rarely meet somebody who was a born Unitarian. They mm-hmm. were all converts. And the reason is the Unitarians who were raised in church would all – it was such a weak religion that if I'm a Unitarian, I marry a Catholic, I'll usually convert to Catholicism. I won't be a very good Catholic, but I'll convert to Catholicism because it doesn't...
Or I just won't feel the need as an adult for religion because I never had a strong religion as a kid, and it just doesn't... It's not something that I need.
But why do we need it anything? Is my question.
Another thing is biology, evolution. Like, there are different stages that you go through in leaving the church, uh-huh. and I think there is a ton of anger that comes with it. You know, and depending on the stage that you're in, I don't know who attacked you, but they might have been at the earlier stages where
they
hate everyone.
I've had people come to, I've had people come to events that I have paid for, planned, bought the food for, done an arrangement, and lectured me on why we don't need anybody doing anything. There's people out there who don't realize how much work gets put into the web resources, gets put into the companies, gets put into all these things. There, in the ex-Mormon world, unfortunately, there's a small handful of people who are doing tons of work for other people, and those other people are lecturing these folks all the time on why they don't need anything. I mean, if you really think to how much you've consumed, and I mean, including myself in this, of what other people have done, you know, you can be at a weenie roast, you know, eating weenies that you didn't pay for in a place that you didn't pay for that somebody set up, complaining about how or saying, hey, aren't we all great anarchists? You know, and that's that second half of the problem is.
Like you said before, leading any kind of leading of ex-Mormons is like herding cats.
It's worse than that. It's like herding cats who all want to bite you. You know,
is it because we don't have a clear goal in what we're trying to do?
And I think it's that, and I think it's partly because people are fucking clueless coming out of the church. They're used to being spoon-fed everything, and they don't realize what it takes to like run a church or run an organization. And I hate to be mean here, but the problem is that we need so much. And the thing I was getting at with the Unitarians, the fear I have in our society today, this goes beyond on Mormonism, is there's a growing secularism, but secularism has failed so far. There have been a few good starts, but has failed to provide the social needs that we evolved a million years with, the things that we absolutely need. We cannot survive on our own. We've let consumerism drive a lot of things, and people without the proper social relationships, it makes them mentally sick. It's not a healthy environment.
And physically sick.
People need each other. And so what I'm afraid of is we might be moving away from an old religious institution that has become of Christianity and Islam and some of these things that have been around for a long time. But we're just making ourselves ripe for it to all repeat itself again because we're not taking care of those basic social needs that the religion evolved to take care of.
So let me ask you, is it better to be a member of the church if you don't believe it, but it's you recognize the value of its social aspect?
What I think
we
need to do
as a
because I know
as an informed adult
think of it that way.
But my problem is that you're starting all over with the next generation to have to deal with all of these issues again.
We're talking about setting parameters for ourselves, high and low.
Parameters for ourselves and building something outside of so we deconstruct Mormonism. Then we have a responsibility to build something else, to take care of one another.
Responsibility.
Do we? Why?
That's just an innate sense that we have.
Cody, you have a responsibility.
You do.
Because you sucked off my teat.
Yeah.
Big time.
And you need to pay it forward.
It's not that bad.
What are you saying?
All right. Good question. So,
because I'm not saying that's not true, but all of us have participated in discussions, in boards.
It's not just
I'll
somebody.
Say I would have left the church one way or the other. Period.
You would have, but these things gave you an outlet, and I'm talking about us all. And when you talk about these boards, it's not just somebody paid the web hosting fee for post-Mormon. Mm-hmm. It's that you have all these people who have been very patient, who were a few steps in front of us. Who guided us. Every single one of us has benefited from others who have come in front of us.
Mentors.
Who have given us a lot. All of us have.
And that's what we're trying to do in general, right? I mean, that's what we're all in this sitting in this room for.
The reason that we're recording
the microphone.
The reason we're recording again right now is the world does not need more Mormon Expression episodes to take care of the first half of the problem. Now, that problem still exists and we'll still work on that problem. What the world needs is help with the second half of the problem. And when we
you mean more trips to Vegas?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Is that the bottom line? No.
Well, so we've done this in our own life. I'll give you an example. You know, realizing the need for community with our children. I had this realization about 2.5 years ago. My children do not know any elderly people other than their grandparents. Because I don't interact with any elderly people. They just don't exist to my children. Now, when I grew up in the LDS church, I remember there was this guy who would get up every other fast meeting, and he talked about bombing runs over Germany. I was bored at the time. Now I wish I could remember every word that he said. Because here was a guy I lived next to, you know, who flew B-17s over Dresden, right? Mm-hmm. I had this chance to interact with people who were older than me, younger people, people in different economic statuses. My kids generally see carbon copies of myself because that's who I make friends with. Other white people who are in the same socioeconomic class, who are ex-Mormons, who, you know, casually drink or whatever, and they don't interact with this other thing. We don't have that bigger sense of community. So we have been working the last year, 2 years to build what we call the living community, right? And it is successful now. We can pay the bills. We actually have
barely. Well, the rent on the
we actually have
building.
What you could say a church with no belief. That has the structure, that has the programs for the kids, that has community that we formed. It's here in South Salt Lake. I think we have about 70 active members now. But we've taken a lot of heat for doing that. Matter of fact, probably of everything I've ever done, I've taken more negativity from setting that thing up, even though the thing has no belief. It's a little more than a social club and really focused on children.
Families
and children. So anyway, that my point is that there is this next wave that I think needs to happen. So when we incorporated, we formed the Whitefields Educational Foundation, and with the charter really has two elements to it. One is to provide information about the church, and that's to help through that first problem. And the second thing in our charter is to actually build a community and
provide support community.
And
resources and support to people.
And that's the things socially. We've done. We've done weenie roasts, and we've done trip to Las Vegas, and we've done a camp out, and we've done the
monthly
cruise.
Gatherings and
we've done gatherings. And I can tell you for at least one person on every one of those has come to me later and said it was a life-changing event for them. Because of that sense of belonging, that sense of community, that sense of morality that comes from having a community.
We all want to be understood, right?
Right, right.
That's what it is.
Validated,
yeah.
Have I convinced you yet, Cody?
No.
No, he still wants to go back to church.
No. There's no way in hell I'll ever go back to church. That's not ever happening.
I guess my plea is that we all need to pay it forward. There are others coming out of the church who have gone through what I've gone through and what you've gone through. And I've said this before, but one of the things that has propelled me along is that when we were struggling up there in Logan, that sense of loneliness that
we
I felt.
Were so lonely.
That isolation. It was so powerful and such a negative influence in my life that it's compelled me to this day to keep working on other. And I am fucking tired of talking about the Mormon church. But there are people who need it. It needs to be done.
I think a huge part of it is the trust factor. When you put all your faith and all your everything, 100% of your soul into an organization, into an idea, and then you realize you just got screwed over, you know. And these people are actually hiding a bunch of stuff that makes it very obvious that, you know, it's heartbreaking and it's hardcore, and a lot of people have a hard time doing anything like that.
Rightfully
ever
so.
Ever again.
I think you're right. And I think that's what I'm challenging us all. We have to push through that. We were burned once, all of us, and we don't want to get burned again. but we have to be compassionate. So there's a million ways to do it, and go be the change you want to see in the world is the thing that Gandhi famously never said, right? Build the world you want to live in. But we're not all builders, and that's fine. Find something else. Find another builder out there. There's 60,000.
And support them.
And support them. And help us build something. You know, what we've done here with Mormon Expression, we've set up the parent company. We've got our nonprofit status. And we're reinvesting in that. We're moving forward. And we're trying to build and solve these two problems. And we will have false starts and stops, I guarantee. I'm announcing today we're starting our Pay It Forward campaign because for a long time, I was hesitant. I've always been hesitant to ask for money. I've always been hesitant to take money. Mormon Expression has always cost us more than we've ever taken from it, Zilpha and I. But what we're trying to do is in the next few months, we want to raise $10,000 to cover our operating expenses and to start funding new things to help people over the next year. And here's my challenge to everybody out there. You are all tithe payers. What we're asking for is 1 month of what you paid in tithing.
Total?
Yeah. We did the math.
Like if you paid 10% for 1 month, that's it.
So, yeah, whatever you paid in tithing per month, make a donation to Whitefield for that, and you know the idea is to fund things like Mormon Expression, to fund things like Feminist Mormon Housewives, to fund things like Mormon Expression Voices.
If you find value in anything that we're talking about right now, that's what it's for.
And if you don't have that kind of money, I understand.
Need roasts.
One-time donations.
Next time it's going to be a sausage fest, though.
That's what I'm talking about.
I'm out.
Hey, you're specifically invited to that one.
Out.
And we're not really looking. What we're looking for is to helping people sort of rebuild their lives and build community and build that connection to make that healthy start.
And you should know that the administrative stuff
powers.
The administrative stuff that we've been dealing with, and especially John, and some stuff that we haven't been dealing with so well. We have recently hired someone to take care of that, and so we need to pay for them. And it's stuff that needs to be taken care of, the website stuff and hosting stuff and just the taxes stuff and just a whole bunch of
little... It got too big. It's unreasonable for John to do everything.
Right, with his full-time job, and that was part of the reason why we had to stop doing Mormon Expression, because it was too overwhelming. Mm-hmm.
But the need is still out there. So, we are a 501c3. Everything that's given is 100% tax deductible.
And now we know that Jesus appreciates the widow's mite.
Yes.
But the widow's mite's not going to help Whitefields. What about people with modest means? How can they help?
Actually, our steady income is built more on people giving $3, $5, $1 a month. And that's where we do get bigger angel donors, which does help, especially when we want to grow into new things. But right now in the VIP lounge, there's 1,000 people, or we're coming up on 1,000 people, and that's the VIP lounge only been around for 13 months. So
that's true. So what did you say? 10,000. So if everybody paid $10,
there we go.
If everybody in the VIP lounge gave $10, then we would have $10,000.
Then our administrator would be paid for the year.
So what we want to do is, it's not what we're going to sink money into our own administrative costs. The reason we made the decision to go ahead and hire an administrator is saying there's this need out there, and we have the corporate structure in place. We've gone through all the work. We've got the tax status. We've got all that stuff. How can we take this and grow it? And we're looking for ways we can meet these needs. And things like Las Vegas, it's not like you shouldn't think that you're donating money so we can send people to Las Vegas, but we do need to pay people time to rent buses and get those things arranged. But it's not like it's paying for, you know, hotel rooms or anything like that. We're very frugal with our money, and we actually have our last three quarters of statements. We need to, but I just been too busy to do it.
That's one of the things that.
I was going to say that's important for a lot of some people to see, to have that, you know, clarity and know. Okay, am I paying for John's, you know, dinner,
booze,
whatever, so, Chris, or is he, you know what I'm saying? So,
I'll say this to ex-Mormons, even if you are paying for my dinner, that's sort of the way things work. There's this expectation of free that's out there that I need to dispel, that things cost money, right? And I don't think that the ex-Mormons or whoever go in and they are about to buy a Twinkie and they say, wait a minute.
You can't buy Twinkies anymore.
No, Twinkies are no.
They're Starbucks. Wait a minute. The CEO of this has a helicopter. Mm-hmm. You know, and he lives in a, you know, like, why am I giving my money to that? But I've seen, and especially, this hasn't been aimed at me as much, but it's been aimed at John DeLynn a lot. And John DeLynn does not take a lot of money, but John DeLynn can take a modest income and people throw a tizzy fit over that. But I can tell you the amount of work. At the height of Mormon Expression, I was doing 30 to 40 hours a week on top of my full-time job. And then if I expense a Subway sandwich, people seem to get bad out of shape. But, you know, the bandwidth.
Which you've never
No.
But you should, you know, if you're working through lunch, I don't know. That's just how things work. That's your point.
My point is that things to get done take resources, and as a matter of fact, I would rather everybody than give us money. I'd rather them go out and build something, build their own community. Absolutely. That's the preferable. But here we have a chance to do something. And my challenge to all the ex-Mormons, as we've been talked about what we've collectively been through, and if you're still listening now, I sound like NPR.
20 more minutes.
But it does that's what it takes. It takes all of us to go in and repair the situation that we're in and build a community that we need.
And don't just do it blindly. Come to some of the functions that you guys have. I mean, it's scary to go because you might not know anyone, but every time we've gone, everyone is so welcoming and so ready to help, you know? And it's amazing how much just talking to someone can help your own situation and help you feel better about where you're at.
It turns people around, and I have met some of the closest and the people who I really consider my family. Mm-hmm. I love my family, but there's this distance caused by religion, and there's people that I really love, and I've met them all through either things that we've put on or things that other people put on. That they've all been through this medium of ex-Mormonism that somebody else has done. And
we're all veterans, right? I mean, it's like veterans can sit in a room and say, oh, you did that, yeah, and no words can be explained. But if you're a veteran of Mormonism, then, I mean, there's that same cathartic experience.
Right.
Same. And it is healing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, I mean, there's no obligation as far as people. Like, I called John the other day to have him come help me move a bunch of heavy stuff, and he did it.
Took out my garbage. It was awesome.
Yeah. You know, why did he do it? He did it because he cared enough to do it, not because, you know, whatever else. Yeah, he's my home teacher, whatever. He did it because he actually cares to do it, you know. And I guess that's probably true with a lot of people that are still in the church. But when you're outside of the church, there's no question.
That's true.
And
when we first went into Davis County, I think there was this remnants of a group, and no one. There were dead emails. It was like something out of like Lord of the Rings, like this ancient civilization. There have been generations and generations of ex-Mormons that have developed their society, made friends, and then moved on. And I've oftentimes fantasized, if we could all get together into a big pile of bodies, that'd be hot.
No, wow.
My attention.
If we could pull just all of it together for one time. I mean, the brilliance of these people
energy.
And the energy, but people have moved on. And if we can somehow battle against that natural entropy we all have and pay it forward just a little bit, a tiny bit. I think we've made the point. Any last thoughts?
I just want to thank you guys for everything that you've put on for us. You know, it's literally changed my life, and I'm much happier because of your efforts. So thank you.
And I'll say, Heather, the first time you came out, and it is scary, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because you don't know what to expect, and this is all new, and you don't know.
It's different to be judged for who you are rather than
what you believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The first time I went to an event, I sat in the car for 10 minutes texting my friend trying to get up the courage. But I went, and 2 seconds later, 3 different people came up and talked to me. And it's awesome. And you're not lonely, and we're not alone.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah, this is my first event with any ex-Mormons. Like, and this is, I mean, I was staying on the doorstep until Rich came up and shook my hand. It's like, do I want to go in? Oh, there's people. Are they coming in? Are they going to walk by? What's going on?
So is the hardest part that we're all naked?
that was a little weird. Leave your clothes at the door. but no, I want to thank John, too, and Zilpha. I mean, this is – I definitely sucked on John's teat, and I'm proud of it. And I'm really looking forward to paying it forward. Like, I'm all for it, and I'm ready to help people.
All right. Well, awesome. Excellent. Well, as always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com. You can check us out there. Check us out on Facebook. You can join the VIP Lounge. Just search for Mormon Expression VIP Lounge. There's always fascinating discussion going on there. And I hear there's a naughty group.
There's a naughty no-no one. I heard about the naughty
no-no. If you learn the secret knock, you can get into the adult group. And there are resources all around. Check out the Mormon stories. Check out Post-Mormon. Check out New Order Mormon. There's things all over the place that are happening. Local groups and of the most awesome people you ever meet in your life.
Yeah. If you need help or just want to say hi to anyone, just shoot us an email too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any one of us.
We're all here.
Yep. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye bye.
Should I not say motherfucker? I've never said that.
Motherfuckers.
I've never said that on the
motherfuckers.
Yeah. Yes.